Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and each week I am truly honored to share the microphone with the most interesting people. These are entrepreneurs, they may be speakers, authors, internet marketers, virtual assistants, and other small business owners who have really wonderful stories to share about their journey and who are excited to freely share their business wisdom, tips, and actionable advice with us. Excuse me, I'm going to have trouble with my voice today. It's just a warning. So in short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And today I get to welcome back my friend Tony Bodo. Now, Tony's been on the show two or three times now. I didn't go back and check, but I think this is either his third or fourth appearance here. Now, Tony is a two-time number one best-selling author. Dog, stop. If you hear pounding, my dog is actually hitting my desk. Today's kind of a messy day, I think. He is a two-time number one best-selling author and the editor of Breakthrough Magazine. He has founded or co-founded five companies ranging from customer experience consulting to small business training to television production. Tony is also an international speaker who has conducted a wide range of workshops and keynotes at personal growth seminars, top-rated entrepreneur forums, and technology conferences. His clients have earned customer service experience awards, including J.D. Power's Customer Satisfaction, Forbes Most Admired Companies, AAA 3 and 4 Diamond Ratings, TripAdvisor Certificate of Excellence, and more. And to give you just one example of his results, the University of Tennessee wrote a case study about how Tony used customer behavioral data to redesign a large convention hotel, and I know which hotel that was, by the way, so it generated $45 million more dollars in revenue per year. His work has been profiled in Inc. magazine, CIO magazine, Restaurant Hospitality magazine, and more. And today, we are going to focus on how you can benefit from the work Tony does to help startups to Fortune 500 companies understand their customers' feedback. This is so important. We're really going to focus on this. And then how he applies these insights to innovate new products, revolutionize their marketing, and train their employees to deliver excellent experiences. Tony, I'm so glad you're here. Thank you for coming back.
Absolutely. I love being on your show, Denise. Such a great audience, and you're such a great host.
It is a great audience, and thank you. It's a great audience. I mean, this podcast gets downloaded thousands and thousands and thousands of times. I finally just gave up keeping track. And, you know, my guests are so wonderful because they give so much information, so many, you know, tips and advice, and of course, those great stories. So tell me very quickly what's up with you recently. It's been a while since we spoke, and just kind of catch me up if you don't mind.
Absolutely. So today is February 3rd. I've got my dates right here. I've been running and gunning, so, you know, try to keep up with the dates. And actually, yesterday was the one-year anniversary of launching our first book. I co-wrote it with Kayla Barrett, and we were on your show last May, I think, actually, talking about the book, The Complete Experience. And within 24 hours, that book, it was a hit. It went to number one status in Amazon. And we've been out doing a ton of speaking. Excuse me. We've been doing speaking. We've been doing a lot of consulting, working with clients that are from literally startup, you know, making less than $100,000 in the expert space, just really, you know, transitioning from corporate to doing something new, all the way up through Fortune 500 companies. And working with them to really have this understanding. I like how you said in the beginning of the show, the know, like, and trust economy. How do they really achieve that? How do they play in that space and become a trusted, known, and liked resource? So we've been having a lot of fun. We launched Breakthrough Magazine through one of my companies. It's for small business owners. It's a great resource. It's a free magazine, so that's been fun. And we're breaking into the TV space now. So we've got a lot of stuff going on, but really today I want to focus so much on that customer experience and what your listeners can take away, because we've learned a lot. I mean, there's billions of dollars a year being invested right now just by the Fortune 500 companies into understanding customer experience and then how to apply that customer experience knowledge and those insights into better marketing, into better servicing, into innovating new products. And small companies are kind of left in the dust because, you know, the money's being spent with these big companies. How do they take advantage of that? They can't buy the software. They can't do these things, the big data mining projects. So what can they do? And that's what I really want to take into our story today and really provide some good insights, because we've been working with a lot of these companies and we've seen what they're doing and we've been experimenting with ways that small companies can really do this as well.
Excellent. What I want you to explain to the audience, so we've had this conversation before, you and I, and you know, if the audience wants to go back and listen to some of those earlier podcasts, I really recommend that you do. But let's talk just for a moment about the differences between customer experience, customer satisfaction. There are big differences, aren't there?
Absolutely. And I'll even take it a step further. So customer service is what you do. You serve your customer. Customer satisfaction is your customer being satisfied, being satiated, feeling like they got what they came for, they paid for, they asked for. That's satisfaction. Customer experience is a bit broader than that. It includes satisfaction, but really customer experience is about what is it that your customer is paying attention to? What is it your customer is feeling? What is it that they're thinking? And so, you know, we may hear about people saying, oh, I'm a customer-centric company. And I don't buy into that a lot because, and I was actually just having a conversation this morning with a human resources director from a large insurance company, and they're talking about their employee retention. I said it comes back to customer experience, because no employee wants to be on the phone talking with customers, A, if those customers are always angry and they can't do anything to make it better, or B, they've lost the meaning behind why they're at work in the first place. And so really understanding that customer experience is the point of measuring what's happening. One way to do that is by measuring your satisfaction, but there's a lot of other ways that we'll talk about as well. It could be your customer reviews. It could be your ratings on TripAdvisor or Yelp or anything like that. So the experience is what people are thinking and feeling. It's how they engage your brand from a perspective of what it means in their life.
You know, that brings me back to Cox Communications. I swear to you, Tony, there was a time when I am almost convinced that when they heard my voice, they just went, bleh, oh, God, she's back. And I got so aggravated with them. And I'm still with them because we're just now getting to where we have a little bit of competition. But I got such a bad taste in my mouth with Cox Communications several years ago that the first chance I get, I will jump ship. And it may be that their service has improved. I don't know. I hate them so much. But what aggravates me the most about having to interact with a live person at their company is no matter what I say, no matter what my issue is, they will always say across the board, oh, I'm so sorry you're having this trouble, like it was their fault. And I've gotten in the habit of saying, stop saying that. You said that to me 4 times now. It's not solving the problem. Please don't say that to me again. I know you're trained to do it, but it's meaningless. Can we just move on to the real issue? It just annoys the garbage out of me, and they keep doing it. They're not solving a thing other than just making my skin crawl.
Well, and that's the thing that, you know, on the look at the side of the employee there. In the world we live in today where we've got these large companies that really are, you know, commercialized everything and have brought it down to a level of a process, in order to reduce our costs, you know, we don't have an account agent assigned to each individual person. You know, we've got these massive call centers and we probably outsource those call centers to other countries. And what happens in the process is we get really good at creating policies and creating processes and teaching people how to do stuff. But we don't teach people how to feel. We don't teach people how to be empathetic. We don't teach people how to engage and really feel what the customer is feeling in a way that they can provide the empathy and the support that's required. And, you know, just going back to my conversation this morning for a moment, you know, one of the things that, you know, I described, you need to help your employees, you know, be more empathetic. And you can't just tell them be more empathetic. You have to help them understand what that is, and by expressing it yourself, by being it yourself as a leader. And the response was, well, the more empathetic they are, the longer they take on the phone call. And I said, that's
and
the
what's
problem.
Wrong
the problem
with
is
that?
Well,
I get
here's the thing.
But that's
here's
what the
thing.
Customer wants.
Well, that's what the customer wants. And if they looked at their metrics differently, and this is you know my area of expertise, you know, I kind of grew up in the space of building customer analytics. And when you just look at the phone call and you say, okay, I was on the phone for 3 minutes and 37 seconds, okay, that's a good number. If I'm on the phone for 4 minutes and 42 seconds, that's a bad number. What they're not considering are the other measures that the company also needs to or should be looking at, and that would be, let's say, how many times the customer has called back for the same issue, right? You've called 4 times for the same issue. I bet you were on the phone a whole lot longer and took up a whole lot more of their customer service time by being on the phone those 4 times rather than someone saying, okay, Denise, let me pause here. Tell me what's happening. I understand you're not feeling good about this. This doesn't sound good, doesn't feel good. Let me get to the source of the problem. Let me take a few more moments with you. And instead of doing that and taking a longer call, if that had to be the case, they're letting 3 or 4 calls because that particular representative and that particular manager are only measured on the moment, on that transaction. They're not measured on the entire journey of the customer or the entire experience. And because of that, they're losing customers left and right.
And that makes sense. On the rare, very rare occasion that I've had somebody who did take the time to listen to me, and I have to say both times it was a woman, which I found interesting. That may or may not mean anything, but maybe they just, you know, caught that I'd had enough and they decided to be mom and take care of it. I don't know what it was. But, you know, I find that they're, well, you know, we're just so sorry you're having this problem. And they just keep parroting that crap back to me. But it doesn't make me feel any better. It just actually irritates me. And I just want them to stop talking and stop parroting the company line at me and listen to me. Because, look, you know me, Tony. I'm very logical. I'm very analytical. I can state my proposition in, you know, 1 or 2 sentences. I'm not going to carry on and on and on. I'm going to tell you precisely what is going on. They really don't want to hear it. They just want to run me through, okay, well, can you hook up this cable to your computer? No, I won't. I've already done all of that stuff. I'm an expert at troubleshooting at home. Now I need you to troubleshoot. It's a round robin with them. I can't begin to tell you how. And they may have improved, but I'm so blind to them right now because I really detest what I've had to go through over the years. They could be the best in service right now, and I wouldn't recognize it. That's how bad it is. And I'm not the only one.
No, and that you're hitting on something that's very important. And this is really part of our conversation today is about word-of-mouth referrals. And the world is changing out there. So as an example, if you're using Cox Communications and you're saying, okay, this is the experience I've had. And if we were sitting down having a cup of coffee, right, you're telling me. Maybe someone at the table next to us could hear us, right? So you're recounting your bad experience to me. You and I right now are having this discussion, and hundreds, thousands, who knows how many people are going to be listening to this and spreading this around. And so the world has changed.
Oh, boy. I'm sorry, Cox. I am. I mean, I didn't even think about that. I just really hate them.
But that's the reality. Well, here's the thing. I know on one of our previous radio shows, this exact topic came up, too, because we were having another conversation that came up.
I know. It doesn't ever cure itself, does it?
Exactly. It's going on. It's still, you know, months later, years later, it's still happening. And the challenge with it is this. You're now out there talking about this. Everyone that listens to the show, we've made the impression 4 or 5 times with the name of the company, you know, talking about it, discussing it, kind of hypothesizing what might be going on there. And so we're putting this impression on the mind of other people. Now, they may or may not be Cox customers. They may have had a different experience altogether. And they may say, well, that didn't happen for me. Point here is that this is viral. This is an message. You know, we're talking to thousands of people right now in this conversation. And I'll go to another carrier, Comcast. there was about a year and a half or 2 years ago, I think it was, there was a viral recorded conversation that a customer was trying to cancel his cable. And he was talking to Comcast, and they get incented.
I remember that. Yeah,
that
was horrible.
To have to keep the person on their account there to not cancel them. And so the representative wouldn't cancel. It went around for several minutes, back and forth. I mean, I don't remember if it was 15 minutes, 20 minutes, maybe longer. And it's frustrating just to listen to the call, just to listen to the recording, because there was no way for this customer to get out of what was happening. He wasn't under contract. He could cancel anytime he wanted to. But it's this sense that, and here's what it comes down to, and I just wrote an article about it last week, and it's really, I would say, hitting the experts and the leaders in customer experience. I've got a lot of interesting and positive feedback with it. But I wrote this article about the real meaning behind customer experience, or the real why it really matters so much. And it's on my LinkedIn page if you want to go there, Tony Bodo. You can just look that up on LinkedIn. I should be the only one out there. But the point of the article is to say that if you really understand what's happening in our lives, I'm going to break this down to use a little science here for a moment, so bear with me if you're not a scientific type. Psychologists have come up with the conclusion that about 3 seconds is equivalent to 1 moment in psychological time. So something lingers in our mind for about 3 seconds. So we have, in a given minute, we could have up to 20 different moments, okay? Now, that's important because then if we look at the course of our lifetime, we can actually calculate how many moments we're going to have over the course of our lifetime. Now, they've also been able to calculate between quantum physicists and psychologists and neuroscientists, they calculate that on the upper end of our processing, our conscious processing, we process about 2,000 bits of information per second. So just to put that in perspective, you can now calculate about how much information we could consciously be aware of over the course of our life. And it comes out, if I did my math right, comes out to about 1.25 terabytes for an 80-year-old person. Now, I share that because what happens here is if you think about a person's life and you think about the fact that in a given person's life they're only going to have 1.25 terabytes of information cross their conscious mind and we can only experience what we're consciously aware of, and you as a customer service agent or you as a manager or leader in a company believe it's okay to treat people like garbage, you're now affecting the outcome of their life, the real outcome of their life. Some of that 1.25 terabytes of information they're going to be processing in the course of their life, they're going to be forming their opinions and beliefs of how the world works, and they're going to be making decisions on their life as a result of that. They're going to be focusing on that when they could be focusing on their wonderful kids or a relationship or who knows what else, something positive and growth-oriented, something that helps the world. But instead, you're contributing in a negative way to their life. And there will be a point in time, I'm putting this out there, I put this in the article, but it's the first time I've ever said this publicly. There will be a point in time that a really, really smart litigator puts together the science behind this and starts going after companies for wasting people's lives, for making them less healthy because of the bad experiences. There's all this science behind mind-body connection. When we have a bad experience, when we have a negative experience, or you know, we're upset about something, it causes our health decline. It causes our immune system to go down. It shortens our lifespan. So there is going to be a smart litigator that comes after these companies that are providing bad customer experiences and tries to sue them. Whether they're successful or not that first time, who knows? But eventually we're going to get there, just like we did in the quality movement in the 70s and 80s when the auto manufacturers were calculating how much risk they could take, how many cars that they would allow explode, and how much a human life was worth. We're going to have the same thing happen in customer experience. It may be 15 or 20 years away, but we're on the path to that. Big data, all of the data crunching we do, the mining, right. We're on our way there. I got passionate there for
sense.
A moment.
I mean, look
I
at
say?
The drug companies. I mean, the drug companies are known for calculating how many lawsuits they can win before they know they're no longer profit. And that means
absolutely.
Deaths and you know, a lot of illnesses. But, you know, it's number crunching for them, which is... I can see where you're going. I admit I just kind of went, what? And then the more I listened, I went, okay, that makes sense.
And you know, if you take it back to the reality, and I faced a near-death scenario many years ago, probably around the time shortly after you and I actually met, and that got me thinking
I remember.
Completely differently about this. And so now I look at it and say, you're affecting someone's life. You're affecting the time that they have with their kids, their spouse, their friends and family, whatever it is, or the creativity they have in this world. So why would we choose to do that? You know, but aside from that, you know, let me use an example. EpiPen is an example of this. And this is going to tie into all the stuff that we're going to talk about as we go through this here today. I guess it was maybe August of last year, EpiPen was in the news. It went viral. And the reason it went viral, EpiPen is basically epinephrine. And it allows people who are going into anaphylactic shock where their lungs, their heart, their nervous systems are shutting down, they're dying. If you would take an injection of the EpiPen, it allows you to your body to basically restart, and it gets you back into a state where you can be stable and live. If you don't get it administered within a short period of time, you could actually die from it. So some people have peanut allergies and other things like that. They go into anaphylactic shock. They need this immediately. Well, EpiPen was being manufactured and marketed by a company. Well, Mylan bought them out in the early 2000s. And over the course of about 8 to 10 years, gradually raised the price so that it went from about $50 per shot to about $350 for a two-pack. $350 for a two-pack. And then in August of last year, they doubled the price overnight. So it was $700. And everyone went crazy over it and said, this is ridiculous. And the reason that this was such a negative impact was because EpiPen marketed themselves, or Mylan marketed the EpiPen, as this answer for parents who were worried about their kids. Peanut allergies have been growing. Other allergies that cause anaphylactic shock have been growing. There was no real solution for it. I mean, you could use a needle, you could inject it, but most kids don't want to have needles, and there's a lot of other things going on there. So it gave parents the comfort of knowing, I don't have to worry about my kid. I can send them with the EpiPen. They can have it in the school office. They can be at their sporting events, and there's EpiPens available there. There was all this work that Mylan had done to basically say, don't worry anymore. You're safe now. We've got your back. And they marketed to mothers, and mothers bought into it, and mothers were appreciative, and mothers supported the brand. They were totally behind it. Then when they doubled the price, it went viral because now parents are saying, am I going to be able to afford this? Is my insurance company going to afford this? Is my kid going to die because the school can't afford to have it on hand? And just like that, the same emotions that Mylan had used to build up the marketing of the EpiPen to the tune of over $1 billion in sales, they turned around and used it against themselves unknowingly, unwittingly. And that ended up shooting themselves in the foot with that. And now there's actually an alternative out there that's been put on the market that's equivalent to EpiPen. And it, in a matter of a few months, it was developed and put out there. And they got approval from the FDA. So now EpiPen just destroyed their own market share by raising their prices, not understanding how things go viral, not understanding customer emotions and what they did to drive their own sales up, that it was going to come back and bite them if they tried to raise prices too high, too fast. So I could go in.
Tony, I have to ask, does nobody, I mean, do they not use human emotion? Can't they predict based on human emotion? Do they even try? I mean, did any single person in that company walk through that experience as a parent or as a person who has allergies? Look, if I get stung by a wasp, if I don't get Benadryl down real quick, I'm in the hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of us out there. Yeah, so, you know, I've never had an EpiPen, but the one drug you can find in my house is Benadryl. In my purse, in my car, it's everywhere. But did nobody say, look, you know, yes, this is a financial thing, but it's also human experience. If I were a person who needed an EpiPen and I was on, let's say, a fixed income, or I was a young mother, what would this do to me? What would the outcome be for me if I had a sick child or if I got sick? What would the outcome be if I couldn't afford it? Would I get sick? Did nobody walk through the human component of this? Well, it's a stupid question. Clearly nobody did. My real question is, why not? Why didn't they apply some human common sense to this problem?
You know, that it is a great question, and I actually searched. I wrote an article about this as well back in August, really trying to analyze it from a customer experience perspective, because it was viral, and I was surprised at how viral it went until I dug in and understood why. You know, I have an EpiPen. I use it because I can go into anaphylactic shock. I haven't, fortunately, for a very long time, but I've got one available, and so it piqued my interest. And so I dug into it. And honestly, on the pharmaceutical side, in the financial side, the stock markets, you look at the experts, you talk to the experts out there, no one could explain why they did it. No one could explain why they took the action and the benefit they saw from doing it. What astounded me even further is that when you look at this in light of what happened with the different AIDS drugs and that, the gentleman's mind slips my his name slips my mind, if I can speak here. But about a year before that, we had this big pricing scandal where something went up by like 400 or 500% and it was helped to treat HIV or AIDS or something like that. I don't remember the exact drug it was. But that went viral. He eventually got arrested. All kinds of stuff happened. And I'm like, you see this happening out there. You can't be blind to that. That wasn't even a year ago, and now you're doing the same thing. And I
it
couldn't understand how
the
their legal team...
I mean, right.
Yeah.
You know, there were so many people at fault here. How did that happen? I mean, that's just rank stupidity, going all the way up through the ranks. How in the world did that happen?
And I don't know if there is someone at the lower ranks that's... And I've worked for companies. I've had clients who are large companies, so I know that this happens. Oftentimes, there could be someone at the lower level, you know, an analyst that says, hey, guys, wait a second. Let me raise a flag. And either the importance of it is not understood, or because that middle management layer in a lot of companies is where things get blocked, they don't want to raise a red flag above that level because their career's on the line, or so they think. And if they were to say, hey, raise the flag here, if we do this, we might have a you know adverse effect. You know, if no one knows that research was done, they're probably safer than if someone knows that was done and it's ignored, right? So there's a number of possibilities. They may not have looked at it. They may not have been aware. With the amount of money that these companies throw at this type of stuff, it's probably just that it didn't get high enough, fast enough, or wasn't understood in importance until after the fact. But the fact that no one could explain it, there was no real good rationale as for why they raised the price, there was no good explanation at all. That consumers could consider reasonable, because we could see the price of something go up and we can say, okay, you know, like when the price of gasoline goes up, right? We don't like it. We complain about it. But we say, okay, it's because OPEC is doing their thing and tightening the amount of supply and all this, you know, or the pipeline broke or something happened, right? We can build a logical reason, whether it's a right or wrong, it doesn't matter. But if we can build a logical reason, we'll buy into it and say, okay, I don't like it, but the company couldn't do anything about it. But when you have a company that can do something about it, you know, either Cox Communication, right, go back to them, they can do something about the way their agents perform. They can do something about the processes they have in place, or so we think as customers, because we don't have another explanation. Or the EpiPen and the pricing of the EpiPen. If we don't have a reasonable explanation, we're going to get upset. We're going to share it. And why things go viral, particularly why things go viral in this case, is because when people feel like their ability, their dominance, their control over a situation is taken away from them, they need to get it back. It's part of human nature. If something is taken away, you're going to fight to get it back. It's how we are wired and programmed. And so when EpiPen takes away threatens to take away the ability for me to protect my child, or protect myself, because I'm not sure if I can afford the EpiPen, and my mind starts working, my imagination starts going on the path, what if I can't afford it? What if I lose my job? What if I don't have health care? What's going to happen then? Is my health care going to cover this? Can I get away with this? Now you're turning all that dominance, that control you gave to them over the situation, you're taking it all back, and because you took it back, as the, you know, if you were Mylan, you're going to be the person that they come after, the company that they come after. Wells Fargo is the same way. If you look at Wells Fargo back in September, I think it was September, they had it broke. And now 5 years ago, 5.5 years ago, they discovered that the way they were incenting people to sign up new accounts, credit cards, checking accounts, all of that, some of their employees, there's about 5,300 of them that had been fired over about 5 years. They were actually getting customers to sign additional forms, signing up for additional accounts that they actually didn't ask for, but the customers didn't know that they were getting these accounts. So if you went in for a checking account, as an example, you might get signed up for a credit card, you might get signed up for a savings account or some other product, because they were trying to sell up to 8 different products to each customer, because they knew that from their data perspective, it was where they call it stickiness. The customers wouldn't leave if they had 8 products. Well, that got translated into, we need to sell 8 products. The CEO even said, 8 is great. That was the mantra. And so some of these lower performing employees decided, I can't keep my job if I don't hit this level of performance. And their only solution that they could come up with was, well, let me cheat. Let me get people to sign forms that they don't need to be signing, and let me open up fake accounts for them, basically. And so there were millions of accounts that were opened. Well, this hits the news in September, even though it had taken 5 years to get there. It finally hit the news because Wells Fargo had agreed to a settlement with the I think it was the district attorney in L.A. or the attorney general of the state in California. And when it hit the news, from that point forward, you can track that by November, I think it was in November, year over year, they had 45% fewer credit card applications, 41% fewer checking accounts being opened. And then in January, like January 2nd or 3rd, it hit the news that Prudential Insurance was also now involved in the scandal because some of the products that were being sold were Prudential Insurance products that could be sold by the bank. And so there was some whistleblowing that had happened at Prudential. People that thought Prudential should know about this, and they had been penalized for bringing it up. So you can see that this type of stuff starts to spiral in a very negative way. And now we're talking about scandals here. But if you bring it in and say, let's look at a local small business, or let's look at an expert, a doctor, you know, someone who's a professional, the same thing can happen in your community. And it may not hit the news. It could hit the news, but it may not hit the news. But if it starts hitting things like Yelp, or if it hits, let's say, TripAdvisor for a small hotel, or it you know, gets into certain circles in certain communities.
Right. In the deep south, that would be the coffee shop.
Exactly. The coffee shop or after church on Sundays, you know, right, or Wednesday evenings, you know, it's the Bible Belt. That's where people talk. And when that happens, it goes viral within your community, and it changes the results you're getting. And you may not have any idea that it's happening. And it could be that you provided service to one person, or you couldn't do something for one person. Now, that person is telling a story to themselves because they're trying to make sense out of why they can't get what they paid for, why they can't get what they think you promised to them. So they've got to make up a story in their mind. It's just how we're wired. We've got to understand things. And so in that process, they start telling other people the story. Because the more they tell the story, the more believable it becomes. And I'm not calling anyone a liar. I'm saying, you know, things happen. But this is how we work as individuals. We have to understand that when we have emotions, we as human beings, we have this gift of being able to explain why we feel the way we feel. And so we try to do the same thing when we have a bad customer experience. We do the same thing when we have a good customer experience. We can say, wow, these guys are amazing. You know, it's like the heavens have opened and you hear the angels singing, right? And that's the way you describe someone else is going to go to that business and they might be disappointed because it didn't happen for them. So there's this understanding of what actually causes and triggers this word of mouth, this viral nature of customer experience, and how does it affect your business? So as we dive into this, you can begin to see it's actually going beyond word of mouth because now, as an example, come bringing it back to our conversation here, this is going out to thousands of people. If I was to go, I do a lot of work in the hotel industry, and if I was to put a note on TripAdvisor or do a review on TripAdvisor and rate a hotel, let's say, you know, I had a bad experience, I rate them as a 1. Now, that's going to pop up in their feed on TripAdvisor, and something like 87% of consumers go to TripAdvisor to review their hotel before they place a booking. So 87% of the customers coming to this hotel likely are out there seeing, oh, he put this bad review out there, and determining, is this something I can tolerate or not? Is this something that I'd be willing to, you know, risk putting my hard-earned money out there or not? Or is there another hotel that I can get at about the same price that has better reviews? And so you've got things like TripAdvisor, you've got Yelp, which a lot of small businesses are in Yelp. There's actually review sites for tires. There's review sites for lawyers, for doctors, for dentists. You name the industry, and I can probably tell you that there's at least one, if not more than one, review sites out there for it. And all of this is shifted because
what happened in 2007, June of 2007, the iPhone was introduced. And with that introduction of the iPhone and then in 2010 the iPad, we now had connectivity and immediate access to information anywhere, everywhere, so we could either create content, you know, go out there and do a review, or we could read reviews and make decisions on our purchases right then and there. I could be standing in Best Buy right now, and Best Buy, if you look at their tags, their pricing tags, in their stores, they have a star rating, and you can actually go to their website and you can go read what those stars mean, what the rating is and what people are saying about the product. Home Depot, if you go online and shop online for Home Depot, probably the same thing for Lowe's. You can see that they have ratings for each of their products there. And these are customer ratings.
They do, and a smart consumer will – I'm going to need a refrigerator, I found out yesterday. Mine decided that it is either going to go to heaven tonight or tomorrow, but it's going to be soon. So I've been shopping for a refrigerator, and what I found, Tony, and I think our audience will find the same thing, is if you go to Best Buy or Home Depot or Lowe's or Sears, wherever it is that you're shopping, and you choose your item, I found the refrigerator I want, but I didn't really like the reviews on, let's say, Home Depot. So I took the name of the product, popped it into Google, and I started comparing the reviews from all of these different sites, and they're all different. So you have to do your homework. I mean, don't just rely on one place. And what I do, too, is I discount the older reviews and I go for the newer ones to see if, you know, these issues have been cleaned up. So, you know, there's a way to do it, but don't just stop at one place to get your review is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. And so let's narrow this in even for your audience. And, you know, what is it you can do? So we've talked about the problem. And if you look at, like, TripAdvisor, just to give you some metrics on the size of this, I love TripAdvisor because from a perspective of sizing, TripAdvisor was the one that really made reviews popular because a lot of people use hotels every year, and they did a lot of advertising early on. So back in 2008, when I was actually in the hotel industry as an employee before I started my company, we only had the occasional mention. I actually ran the customer experience department for a large hotel brand, and we only had the occasional mention. It wasn't very popular. It wasn't a big deal at that point in time. We would get some mentions on occasion. By 2013, according to their stats, they had 100 million reviews, and they covered 2 million locations, so hotels, restaurants, destination sites. Today, they have 435 million reviews, and they cover 6.8 million locations. So in about 3.5 years, maybe 4 years, they have quadrupled plus in size. And everyone is out there. Everyone is going to get stuff. Now we've got Yelp as an example, which is very popular for a lot of local small businesses and that. Incidentally, if you go to thecompleteexperience.com, I've got articles at the bottom of that page. You can go read some of this if you want to get more of these stats and understand more of how to do some of this stuff. Go there. There's some great content there. I love pushing this stuff out there so people can do stuff about it themselves. But upwards of 92% of customers read online reviews. The sites are out there. We have the technology to connect. We could be sitting in the parking lot, and I've done this myself, sit there in the parking lot or actually go into the store, as you just mentioned, Denise, and actually review a product or review a company and say, do we want to do business with these people? And what's really shocking when I start digging into this, 51% of customers will select a local business based on reviews. However, and this is going to tap into your world a little bit more, over 50% or about 50% of small local businesses do not even have a website. And if they don't have a website, most of them haven't even claimed their business on Yelp or Facebook or anywhere. But people are putting reviews out there, but they haven't claimed it.
I know, and I wanted to talk to you about that, so I'm so glad you brought that up. Keep going.
Right, so if you're, let's say you're a brick-and-mortar business. Let's use that as an example. So maybe you're a store. Actually, one of the articles I wrote, I used a tire shop because I had to go tire shopping for my car. And I went out there on Google and said, I know where I normally go, so where could I go if I wanted to have a different experience? Because I know where I go, it's okay. It's not great, but it's okay. What else could I do? Who else is out there? And so as I start Googling and looking out there, in the first page of results, if you're not in the first page of results, there's a 2% chance that someone's going to choose your local business. I mean, 98% of the business happens on that first page. Well, there's only so many slots on that first page, and you could spend a fortune trying to get on that first page. But what comes up on that first page are the Google ratings for tire shops, or the Yelp ratings for tire shops, or, you know, Facebook, a particular Facebook page for a particular tire shop. You know, they had their ratings up there. So you can get on the front page of Google by gaming the system effectively, and you do that by claiming your business on Yelp, on Facebook, or on, you know, Google My Business, or whatever site is relevant for your particular business. Because people are out there saying, you know, they're typing in tire shop reviews or doctor reviews or lawyer reviews. And when they type that in, it's going to pop up the sites to go to. So the first thing, the first step for any business, especially brick-and-mortar businesses, is to claim your business on those sites. Figure out which ones. Go out there and Google. Google your type of business you are. Are you a tire shop? Are you a restaurant? Are you a Mexican restaurant? Are you a doctor's office? And find out what sites come up, and then go there and claim your business. Start with that. You can do that in about 15 minutes, maybe less. It's not hard to do. And frankly, with every site that I've looked at, every one of these review sites, they're free. You can claim your business for free. So there's no excuse for you not doing that.
I was just going to ask you about that because I think Yelp, and I don't know this, but you know, I think Yelp wants you to pay them every month. There are a few of them, but so basically you can go claim them and just kind of let them sit if you have to, if you don't want to pay. Does that sound right?
No, actually, from everything I've researched so far, and there's so many different ones out there, the details change quite a bit, and they're all competing with one another, because Yelp, as an example, is trying to compete with TripAdvisor. But what I've seen recently, and I believe I'm accurate in saying this, I believe Yelp, TripAdvisor, Google My Business, and Facebook, which those are the four that I tend to see a lot of people need to claim, especially if you're a small business, local business, brick and mortar, those I believe are all free, that you can actually claim your business on there. And you can monitor reviews and get basic stats, and you can actually respond to customers who put reviews out there. I believe all of that is free on each of those.
Okay, say that again. I got Google My Business, Yelp, and Facebook, of course. What was the fourth one?
TripAdvisor. Like if you're a hotel, even if you're part of a big chain, you've got to be on TripAdvisor. Most hotels are now, but it's kind of a standard, right? But if you're, let's look at the professional side for a second. If you're a doctor, healthgrades.com, or there's a lot of other doctor services. I think WebMD may have one as well. But there are a number out there. I actually just found a few this morning out there looking to see what was new. If you're a doctor, if you're a lawyer, now lawyers are interesting. I have a brother who's a civil rights lawyer, and I've had conversations with him about this. Lawyers are interesting because you've got to be careful, and it depends on your industry. So, you know, be informed. I'm not telling you the legal side of this. I'm just telling you a customer experience side of this. Legal professionals in other regulated industries, potentially financial services, financial advisors, those types of industries, you've got to check with your attorneys to see what you can and cannot do. From a perspective of the legal field, there are limits to what you can do because they're not allowed to advertise in the traditional sense of advertising. You know, they're not allowed to say certain things and do certain things according to their codes of ethics. So you've got to be aware of what to do in your industry. But don't be scared of it. Don't be scared of it. Just go find out what it is. You can at least claim your business on those sites and take control of it. So when you're claiming your business, you just take control of it, and you can manage and monitor what's happening there. That gives you some more control. But then if you're doing well out there, you can actually ask your customers, you can say, would you be willing to go out and write a review? Now, I have a couple of rules around this, just kind of rules of thumb in my case. I tell people, number one, you've claimed your business. You found out when people go searching, what do they find? What comes up on the first page? Go claim those sites, right? Number two, when you're servicing your customers, never let them out the door, or never let them to complete their contract with you, their services with you, whatever it may be, whether you're professional or whether you're a brick and mortar, without understanding how they're feeling about what they received. Try to resolve the problems you can. There's a certain point at which we've just got customers who are not the right fit for us, and they may never be the right fit. So in those cases, you've got to know when to cut bait. You've got to know when to just let go. There are some customers who are just bad customers. But let's say you're not dealing with someone who's just being a bad customer. You've done everything you can to make it better.
You don't have to encourage them to go onto your site to review. But if you've got someone who's very positive, they're gushing with positive emotions, that's a technical term in my book, if they're gushing with positive emotions, encourage them, choose a site, whether it's Yelp, Google My Business, Facebook, I don't care which one it is, whichever one you want to push and promote and get, you know, use to get up in the rankings, go send them to that site. Even have a little business card printed out. If you're a brick-and-mortar store, hand them a business card and say, hey, I'm so happy you had a great review. We get a lot of our business from, insert whatever the site is, from Yelp, from, you know, TripAdvisor, from Facebook, from Google. Can you go to this web address and put in a review for us? That would be great because you can tell other people about your experience and what to expect from us. And customers who had a great experience really want to reciprocate. A lot of them will say, yeah, I would love to do that. Not everyone will. But if you start having them go out there and give these great reviews, you will start to move up the charts because the way the algorithms work on all those sites is that the more reviews you have and the better your reviews are, the higher you go. And that's important because as you move up those sites, when someone is out there searching for tire shop or lawyers or doctors and Yelp appears or Health Grades appears or whatever it is, whichever site you're going to, and you're in the top 10 or top 15, you're likely to get more business than if you were hidden somewhere down in the bottom of that site.
Okay, and that makes perfect sense. So basically, if you're a brick-and-mortar business, no matter how small you are, I live in a small rural town on the outside of it, actually, and there's this little tiny dry cleaner that's been around for literally 100 years. The building looks like it's leaning. They have a Yelp page. They do. I mean,
yep.
If you don't know that business is there and you're not looking for it, you will run right past it. You can walk past it. It's so tiny. They have a Yelp page. Somebody in there is doing some pretty good business.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it was funny because when I was doing the search for the tire shop, the Facebook page that came up, as soon as it popped, I didn't even have to open it up. It was like 4.5 stars. And I was like, wait a second.
Oh, wow.
I know that shop. I know exactly where they are. And so they were actually promoting their Facebook page more than they were their own website because that was getting pushed up. Now, here's the advantage to that.
Right.
Google, Yelp, TripAdvisor, the Facebook business pages, you've got these massive Fortune 100 companies who are experts in SEO pushing their sites, their tools to the top of the Google search engine or Bing or whichever one you want to go to. So you don't have to worry about the SEO. You don't have to worry about paying for all of that on the front end. You want to have a good website, right? You want to have a great website. But if you're on these review sites and you're pushing yourself up these review sites, people are going to go to the review sites and they're going to see you there. So even if you don't have a web page yet, get your business on these sites, on these review sites.
Now, I'm wondering, there's with Google Me Now or Google My Business, you have to have a business page. And a lot of businesses that are not brick and mortar, and this may be a question you can't answer. We may both have to kind of look at it and come back to it later. But a lot of businesses maybe don't, they're operated out of their home. My landscaping company, for one, I mean, he does not want his home address out on the Internet, obviously. So my question becomes, if you have a Google brand page, are you able to leave reviews on that? And I'll be honest with you, I don't know the answer to that. So it's something that we all definitely need to look at because not every brick-and-mortar business, so to speak, is a brick-and-mortar business. They may be, a yard service. Yard and landscaping may be both. They may be a service organization that simply does not have an office location. So that may or may not pose a bit of a problem. So I'm curious as to how that all shakes out.
Well, and that's a really good question. I think there are some ways to handle that right now. So as an example, I think on Facebook you could potentially put – I don't think you're required to put the address in Facebook of where you're actually located.
No,
so
you're not.
Professional services.
I'm thinking more Google brand pages because a brand page can take the place of a local business if you don't want to give up your address. But I'm just wondering, are reviews even possible on that? And I should know this, and I'm embarrassed that I don't, so I will be doing some homework today.
Well, I would love to hear back what you find because from what I found, like Yelp and TripAdvisor, some of those require that you have a physical address, right? That's part of it. And Google may be one of those, as you're saying. But if, let's put it this way, if people are looking for you, that's why I go back to the first step is Google the type of business you are and see what comes up. What is the review site that comes up? And if you don't have a physical address, what can you do about that? Where are other people? How are other people dealing with this? If you don't have a physical address, you may see, is it possible to use one of the mailing addresses? Right now, if they try to map you, they're going to put you in the wrong place. But that may be something. Right. Get one of these shared office spaces. You know, and it may be worth you getting. What if you even rented a shared office space, even if you never used it? If it's, you know, $50 a month or something like that for a very low end. Like we have in Nashville here, we have the Entrepreneur Center. You can become a member of the Entrepreneur Center, I think, for like $100 a year. And, you know, you could use that potentially as your mailing address. I mean, you can check with those locations, but there are often some very inexpensive ways to do that, that you can say that this is where my office is located. Now, no one's going to ever visit you at your office, but there are ways that you could use that potentially to get around those situations. You just have to read up on the rules and maybe even contact the, you know, Google or whomever it is to say, this is my situation. I want to use your service. How do I do that? And they'll give you the answer. But typically, like let's say it's the lawn care, Angie's List. Angie's List is a great place to go for that type of thing. So you may have reviews on Angie's List and you get ranked that way. If you don't want to use your address, there are ways to other services out there to use.
Excellent. I am thinking of somebody in particular, so this is all very helpful. So how do you, and I wanted to get off of that just a little bit, excellent information. Thank you, Tony. But what I need, we're running out of time. I'm starting to panic a bit. So when you're building your business and you're talking to your customers and you're trying to really be, let's call it a customer-centric company, how do you get your customers to understand, or how do you understand what your customers believe is your unique value proposition? I mean, how do you ask them? Do you poll them? How do you find out what they are actually thinking? Because I have found out in my years of business that what we think we're offering is sometimes not even what the client or your audience wants. So sometimes you have to go out of your comfort zone and just start asking questions. What do you think?
No, that is a great question, Denise, and that's actually one of the things that I really wanted to tap in here. And again, I work with clients that are sometimes, you know, they're making under six figures. And we take some of those on because we're trying to help them understand where they're going to go. They're ready for fast growth, but they can't get there unless they get the sales. And so one of the things, the first thing really do is distinguish between three types of questions. And Simon Sinek, I don't know if you've ever read or watched his TED Talk or read his books, but he does a great job of describing this. He's phenomenal, and I think I use his format because I haven't seen anyone break it down any simpler than this. There's the what you do, there's the how you do it, and there's why you do it. And so that format is when you're talking about your company, you know, here's our big why. Here's what we believe. Here's why we do what we do. You know, as an example, you heard my passion earlier about why I love working in the area of customer experience, because I know I'm actually helping save people's lives. I know I'm impacting the course of human history because I'm helping people live happier, more creative, helpful lives, right? So my why is a big why. How I do what I do is analysis and training and writing articles and all that kind of stuff, doing these interviews, right? What I do is I help companies actually improve their customer experience and sell more. Now, you can take all that stuff, you can flip it around and look at it differently. You can say, what do my customers think I do? How do they think I do it? And why do they think I do it? And start asking those types
again.
Of questions.
Say that again,
what
if you don't mind.
Yeah. What do my customers think I do?
Uh-huh.
How do they think I do it? And why do they think I do it? And that why question could be, why do they love it so much? And you could switch it to be something more like that. Now, if you get into this, almost everyone out there is saying, oh, yeah, I'm listening to my customers, and they're listening for the what question. They're listening for, you know, did you do this? Did you do that? Yes, we did this. Yes, we did that. And they're at that level. It's like, think about a website. It's like the facts and features. this is the service we offer, right? Everyone out there on their website has got some type of here's what we offer. Customers aren't looking for that. And I'll go in depth here in a moment. But then you have to look at the how. How do we do that? How do your customers feel and think? It's not just what they think, it's also what they feel. They think and feel we do it really well. And that's where the emotion comes into play. That's when they describe, these guys are amazing. They did this, this, this. So the what is what they actually did, how you feel about it. And now the why comes in, because the why is, why do they do it so well? Oh my gosh, these guys are amazing. They are just so caring for their customers. They want to make sure you have an amazing day. So these are all stories being made up in the customer's mind, but they're telling you the why, they're telling you the how, and they're telling you the what. If you stop at the what, you're not going to convert a lot of people. If you dig into the how and you start to rewire your website so that it starts communicating the how using the customer's language, and then you also communicate the why, that customers think you're doing something, you're going to attract more of the customers who love your why, love your how, and want your what. So you use your customer feedback to rewrite your marketing content, to restructure your web page, and you'll attract more of the customers who love you already.
So you're almost turning it into an actual conversation, right? Look, we all, there is a place on your website for, you know, how, what you do and, you know, what your services
right.
are, but I don't think it needs to be on the front page. I think you need to first engage the people that visit you,
right.
like, you know, these are what people say about our company. These are the superlatives that they're using. So what do you think needs to be on, when people get to you, when they get to your website, what needs to kind of be right above the fold? What's going to hit them right in the eye where they're going, oh, I must see more?
Perfect question. So, again, go to thecompleteexperience.com, and you can see how we do this on our page. Now, our page is not the best out there. We're like the cobbler's children. We look at our site last versus our clients.
You're speaking my language. I'm a web developer.
So,
mine's always the last one in the queue.
So I caveat it with that, but here's what you need to have. You need to have a minimum of 3, and I would prefer 5 things above the fold. Now, also, you've got to be aware, do most of your clients find you with a laptop, or do they find you on a mobile device? And so that, because the fold, what's above the fold, what's in that first area that loads up on the screen before you scroll, you've got to make your impression there. You don't have the opportunity to scroll. You've got to say, what can I do right here? You've got to have 3 to 5 social proofs on that site. And a social proof basically means someone else is saying you're amazing. And I'm going to give you a list here of things that you can use. So one is a short customer quote that's emotional. It could be one liner. It could be a part of a sentence. And then also include, if you can, a relevant picture. So preferably of the person. But you could have a person that looks like they're engaging in that activity that the customer is related to. Possibly a short customer video or testimonial. Definitely you want to look at awards or third-party recognitions that you've received. Or in my case, as an example, if you go to my main website, tonyboto.com, you'll find on there, I've actually got a list of some of the things that you read, J.D. Powers and TripAdvisor and Forbes Most Admired Companies. My clients have earned these awards. I've helped them get there. So I put that on there. Ratings. If you've got any type of star rating, again, any of these sites, you can even just take a snapshot of that in the worst case right now, put that on your front page. But most of the APIs that you can just hook them to your page and you can do it that way. But the star ratings alone can actually increase the number of sales. Just people seeing that, they trust you more. Then you want to look at if you've got a bar chart or like TripAdvisor has a bar chart, how many 5s, how many 4s, how many 3s, you know, et cetera. If you can put that on your site, that's a great thing to put up there because now people are seeing social proof of other people that are out there doing it. Press logos, where have you been in the press, who's covered you, using logos of well-known, either in your industry or in your community, well-known resources, raises your credibility, and use full-color pictures of those logos, not black and whites. I don't care how it may look, make your site look something less elegant, it doesn't matter. This is not about you and winning awards on your website, this is about you getting business. You can put client logos if you've got permission to do that, some of your more well-known clients. And then for some companies, if you don't see you have enough of this, then you can do what Amazon does, which I think is brilliant. They have basically categories called picks. So it could be editor picks. It could be bestseller picks. It could be most liked by customers, you know, whatever it is. Depending on the type of business you have, you drop those things in there. Now, again, 3 to 5 of these should be above the fold. You should be winning people over, and you shouldn't even have an offer above the fold unless it's, you know, join our email list here. That's about the only thing that you want to have if you're a professional or if you're in one of these businesses. You don't have to worry about your product because your SEO and all the other stuff on your site is going to get people to your site. When they get there, you want to win them over and say, now everyone else has got to compete with me, as opposed to you competing
right.
with everyone else.
Right. And if anybody is wondering how in the world you can find out how your site is being viewed, most of the newer templates already include this information in there. There are plugins that allow you to find this information instantly. You'll find out how much of your traffic is coming from iPad, from, you know, Androids, from iPhones, from laptops, and you're going to find that most of it is not coming from a desktop. It's coming from handheld devices. So you really need
to, which is
when you're planning,
you have more space on the
Right. So when you're building, you know, a new website or planning to rebuild one, definitely take that information into, you know, your web developer should know all this, but if they don't, hire another web developer. It's just my word of advice.
Absolutely.
Listen, we stopped streaming, so we lost the people in the chat room, but Donnie, can you stay for just a couple more minutes?
Absolutely.
Because we're still recording. Okay, so I know we talked about, you know, what's changing in word of mouth referrals. I did warn you, I didn't feel so great today, so I'm stumbling a bit. And what brick-and-mortar businesses must do today, we covered that, which was great, great, great. Is there anything else that you feel that we might have missed? Because this is a very fast 60 minutes, and I feel like I didn't even begin to tap into some of the questions that I needed to ask you. So is there anything that you wanted to kind of get out there before we go?
I mean, I think that's the most important stuff that we covered there. I try to make sure we got through that. I would say I think an area that I didn't go deep enough into, but I want to tap into a little bit more for the moment, is on that professional services side, especially with experts. So let's say you're an author or you're a coach or you're a consultant and you're a relatively small shop, right? Or a virtual assistant for that, you know, for that matter. You may not have a review site out there for you. They may not exist yet. And so in those cases, what you want to do is you want to bring as many of these social proof elements to your home page. That's why it's so important, because if you don't have a review site to get on, you want to be able to bring those up. And so make sure you're really focused on that. But the other side that a lot of people just seem to forget about is LinkedIn. Getting reviews on LinkedIn for the work you've done is huge.
I wondered when you were going to get to LinkedIn.
And I'll admit, it's funny because as we were doing, you know, prepping for this interview and that, I said, you know what? LinkedIn is a place to be. You've got to do this ton of publishing on LinkedIn. All my blog posts end up on LinkedIn at some point. And I don't even have recent reviews on LinkedIn. I haven't asked anyone for those. And so I was like, you know, again, cobbler's children here. But you've got to be on LinkedIn. You've got to have recent reviews on LinkedIn, because otherwise people are going to be like, is this real or not? You know, is it relevant or not? So you've got to be tapping into LinkedIn. And there's actually some great programs out there to teach you how to use LinkedIn, the resources and that, to build more business. But at least start asking your current clients to go out there and, you know, if you're a professional, a coach, an expert of some sort, ask them to generate a review for you and put it up there for the work you've done for them.
Oh, absolutely. Now, when you say, let me interrupt you for just a second.
Mm-hmm.
When you say your blog posts wind up on LinkedIn, I'm assuming not just as a link. I'm assuming that you're duplicating them and putting them up as a LinkedIn Pulse article. Is that correct?
Absolutely. That is a great question.
Okay.
So you know me, I'm an analyst.
A lot of people don't know
so
the
I'm
difference.
Working.
So LinkedIn, I'm sorry, LinkedIn Pulse is,
right.
is something completely different from just slapping a link up there. So if you are on LinkedIn, look for articles. You know, post an article. You can save them. You can come back to them. And they go everywhere. It's very important to be on LinkedIn Pulse. So that's my little pitch for LinkedIn.
Yeah, so I've actually done a lot of research in this one on my own side, and what I found was if I put an article on my blog, right, on my own website, and then I would take an excerpt of that and put that on, this is before they had the Pulse articles available, I would take an excerpt of that, put it in my feed, you know, and publish my feed, and then I would go share that with all these different groups I'm part of where it was relevant, and I would not get the click-through rates. I would get a couple likes here or there, but I knew people weren't clicking through because I could see from the stats on my website that the views I got did not match with the click-throughs that I was getting to the website. And so I made a decision at a certain point. I said, you know what, it's not about getting people to my website. It's about people getting to know me, like me, and trust me. And it was a hard decision, and it took me a while to actually make the decision because I was afraid, what if I'm screwing up here? And so I actually now, what I do is I'll publish first on my website. I will take that and have that immediately duplicated and put on LinkedIn. And I do it in an article on Pulse, right? From there, I share that to all the different groups that I'm a member of that it's relevant to share it to. Now, another side of this is that when I go to Facebook and I use my business account on Facebook, I actually take the LinkedIn article and I publish that in Facebook, like the links to the LinkedIn article. So people are coming from Facebook to LinkedIn to read my article. They're not going to my homepage. Now, most people would probably argue with me, but I've done the stats over and over again, and I see that far more people go to LinkedIn than will go to my site. And again, it's about getting people to know, like, and trust me. And so
right.
I put them out there, and I direct everyone there, and also because I want the ratings to go up. So if I drive everyone to LinkedIn, and my LinkedIn article ends up being the most, you know, highly rated for that topic, I'm going to get the people to say, well, I need to go hear it. In each one of my articles, I have multiple links back to my website for other content.
Exactly.
Download this, go see this, go read this article. But I'm always driving people to LinkedIn and my Pulse articles there because I want that to go live. I mean, if you look at BuzzSumo and some of the topics that are circulating there and reaching the top levels, they're LinkedIn articles. They're not websites. Right.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And I tell my clients the same thing. We need to be in multiple places. And I'm going to give you a nifty little trick to the audience, and you may already know about this, but a lot of people don't know that you can do largely the same thing on Facebook. Do you use Facebook Notes?
You know what? I did. When we were working together back several years ago, and I had you managing a lot of that for me, I was using the notes, and I got away from doing that, and I haven't gone back to it. I really need to go back to that. So, yes, thank you.
It's another avenue. I mean, you're not going to get, and I promise you, unless things change dramatically, you're not going to get, you know, the readership that you get in LinkedIn. But Facebook has its own audience, and it's open to Google. So your word is going out there all over the place. So what I do with my client stuff is I put it on their blog. We're not necessarily trying to drive traffic to the blog. We want it, but it's not number one priority. Then eventually, because we don't want to get Google slapped, we don't want to put the same stuff out, you know, every day, I'll, you know, actually take that same article and, you know, maybe a week later it's on LinkedIn Pulse. Maybe a week or two after that it's on Facebook Notes. Then you've got a couple of links that you can, you know, go out and put out on Twitter, put on Facebook, put on LinkedIn. So, you know, use them all is my best advice.
And one of the things that I find, you know, to drive traffic on Twitter, I'm aggressive in my use of hashtags. Now, the structure I use, because again, I'm studying this and watching what happens, I put whatever it is the key phrase that I want people to know what this article is about or the quote or whatever it is. I put that. I put the link, and then I'll put the hashtags afterwards, right? And I direct people, read this, whatever else. But the hashtags always come in afterwards because no one really cares what the hashtags are. They just pop up, right? So I don't
–
sometimes I will, but I usually don't mix the hashtags before the link. And the other thing is that
it people
don't
realize –
It
gets confusing.
Exactly.
It gets quite confusing. If you're looking on Twitter, you're like, what am I supposed to poke here? Where's the link? So you have to separate them.
Exactly. And putting pictures on things. I mean, people – I'm amazed at how many tweets go out there, even for business people, and they don't put a link or they don't put a picture, they don't put something to attract attention. People will click on things that have pictures, have links, that's how you drive traffic.
Yep.
I get 30 to 40 followers a day on Twitter when I'm engaged. There's some days where I actually, like Thursdays, this is my stats. Thursdays I don't engage on Twitter very much or LinkedIn or anywhere because Thursday, for whatever reason, readership drops off. I've seen this across the board again and again, so my efforts are wasted. So I don't spend a lot of time engaging on Thursdays. I just have some automated stuff that may go out. But if I'm going to engage with people, and I do actually do some of my own tweets. I don't just use Hootsuite or some of those products, because there's a different way of responding in the moment than what I would say if I just did a generic response to every single person.
Exactly. And, you know, I mean, you really do need to kind of be everywhere and do it thoughtfully. Mm-hmm. Do your homework. Do it thoughtfully. You don't need to be in your face slamming, you know, this is me, this is what I do, come buy my
right.
stuff. You do want to engage, and you do want to offer really great information. And I think once you get a reputation for being a resource, you're good. You're gold.
Right, and that's the value of when you've got LinkedIn and Facebook and you're doing like the LinkedIn Pulse, the Facebook Notes, people are getting to know you before they have to go to your site. We don't want to go to another site. We don't want to get hammered by sign up here and do this. So let them get to know you on these sites. Invite them. Give them a way to get to you. I actually do 3 to 4 links depending on what the article is about, where they can go get more information on things. And they'll come to your site eventually. And they may even just engage with you on LinkedIn there and never go to your site. And that's totally fine. The only purpose in really having the blog right now on my site is that if people do get to my site, somehow they get there, they see that I have a whole lot of published content out there. And like, okay, this guy's a great resource. But honestly, I could probably go without my blog and still be fine.
I think a lot of people are heading in that direction, to be honest. I've been noticing that, and it does make sense. Tony, this has been a wonderful conversation, and thank you for – oh, man, we're 11 minutes over. Thank you for staying. Where can people find you on the web?
The best place to go to right now, thecompleteexperience.com. We are actually – last year we published the Kindle version of our book, and I believe it'll be next week our print version's coming out, and so you can get a copy of that. You can go to CompleteExperience.com to get more information there. And if you want to connect with me on Twitter or LinkedIn, my hashtag or call signs, whatever you want to call them, they're Tony Bodo. That's TonyBodoh. That's for both LinkedIn and Twitter. On Facebook, it's Tony Bodo International.
Great. Well, Tony, thank you so much for being with me here today and for staying over a bit long. It's always wonderful chatting with you. You're one of my favorite guests, and I know our audience enjoyed the huge takeaways as much as I did. I mean, I actually learned a couple of things that, well, one, I thought I should have already known, and now I have to go research it. But I learned a couple of things at Yelp, and I didn't know all that, so thank you so much for that. And for those in the chat room, the show will be available for download in just a few minutes. And you can also find us on iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Tony Bodo. And I will see you next week. Tony, thank you.
Thanks, Denise. It's always a pleasure.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.